The Rainbow Road by Sangharakshita, Windhorse Publications, 1997. Read by Subhadra. Poem by Omar Khayyam, circa 1050 to 1123. You asked, what is this transient pattern? If we tell the truth of it, it will be a long story. It is a pattern that came up out of an ocean, and in a moment returned to the ocean's depth. Chapter 1. Giants and Dragons. On Sunday mornings, when the weather was fine, Father used to take me to see my grandmother, pushing the perambulator with the cream-coloured silk awning through 2 or 3 miles of southwest London streets. As soon as he had swung open the front gate, I used to run up the path and rattle the shining brass letterbox until someone came to let us in, all the time peering eagerly through the coloured glass panels of the big green front door. The hall never failed to interest me, and never did I pass through it without pausing to look up the Nepalese kukris and Chinese swords and chopstick sets with which the walls were decorated, and rarely could I refrain from ringing the Tibetan ritual handbell that stood in a corner behind the door. What most of all drew my attention was the big Chinese picture on the left-hand wall. This Father had lifted me up to look at ever since I was a baby, and it was thus among the most familiar objects of my childhood. Almost square in shape, it depicted an august and mysterious personage seated cross-legged on a kind of throne. He was arrayed in loosely flowing robes, and behind his head was a nimbus. His features, which were markedly oriental, with slant almond eyes that gazed into the far distance, were expressive of a remarkable combination of
benignity
and power. This enigmatic being was surrounded by half a dozen figures, some making offerings, others playing on musical instruments. None of them was more than a tenth of the size of their master, whom for this reason I called the giant. Running into the sitting room, I found objects to gaze at, and even to handle, which were hardly less wonderful than those in the hall. The Chinese cloisonné vases were as fine as any of those which, in later years, I saw in Tibetan temples and at the houses of wealthy Chinese friends, and the exquisite shape of some of them has been in my experience unique. One great flagon-shaped pear, with gold dragon handles, depicted houses, gardens, and human figures. Even now, at a distance of more than 40 years, I can still see a favourite figure in blue gown and black cap, standing pensively among the toy hills. Round each of the other vases, all of which were a deep, rich blue, coiled a five-clawed imperial dragon with white beard and tusks, red horns, black eyes, purple mane, and scales picked out in gold. Each dragon has its jewel and spat flame in its defence. Of these mysterious beasts, it never occurred to me to feel afraid, and certainly they were never for me, as they are for the Christian tradition, symbolical of evil. It was therefore without astonishment that I learned in later life that, to the Chinese, the dragon had been for thousands of years the symbol of the yang, the bright, masculine, creative principle of the universe, even as the phoenix, with which I was unacquainted, was the symbol of the yin, the dark, feminine, destructive principle. On the mantelpiece was a small, sedent bronze image, which, when able to talk, I learned to call the Empress Dowager. When I shook it, it rattled. This figure, the features of which I remember as well as those of any living face, I now know represented not the last Manchu ruler of Imperial China, but the Goddess of Mercy, Kuan Yin, the feminized Chinese version of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, one of the most popular figures of the Indian Buddhist pantheon. The rattling noise must have been produced not, as I then supposed, by a stone, but by one of those holy relics which the Buddhists of China, like those of Tibet, frequently sealed in images. In grandmother's kitchen there hung, on opposite walls, the portraits of two men, one in naval, the other in military uniform. The man in the first, which was considerably larger, wore a walrus moustache, and must have been about 30. The man in the second picture, which was slightly yellowed, had a small trim moustache, and seemed to be in his early 20s. At that time it puzzled me very much to be told that both men were my grandfather, for Nana, as we called her, had been twice married and twice widowed. By each marriage she had had two children, a boy and a girl, father being the eldest. It was her second husband who was responsible for introducing into the house the exotic objects described. Of partly Portuguese descent, he had travelled widely, at one time serving in the Merchant Navy. At the time of the Boxer Rebellion, he was working for the Imperial Chinese Government on the construction of railways, and, having a mania for curios, took advantage of the sack of the Summer Palace at Peking to add to his collection. Grandfather was also a photographer, it seems, for there was an album of photographs taken at the time of the rebellion. Kneeling on the ground, hands pinioned behind their backs, were rows of naked rebels, some with their severed heads already at the executioner's feet. My sister and I spent many happy hours looking at these pictures, until one day Nana realised that they were not the most suitable thing for children to see. About Nana's first husband, my own grandfather, I knew even less than I did about her second. This was partly because he had died so young that father had no recollections of him to share with me. All I knew was that he came of a good Suffolk family, being the youngest of eight brothers, and that after their marriage, he and Nana, the daughter of a Norfolk smallholder, had gone to live at Woolwich, where father was born. Grandfather was then working in the War Office, on account of his fine copperplate hand being assigned the responsibility of writing out the commissions that went to the Queen for signature. On his sudden death from pneumonia, Nana was left to support herself and two small children, one of them still a baby. Being a woman of great strength of character, she met the situation courageously, and from odd reminiscences of hers in later years, I gathered that at different times she had worked as charwoman, parlourmaid, and housekeeper. After 5 or 6 years of this hard life, she had married again and come to live in Tooting. Between father and his sister, who was also my godmother, existed a very strong affinity. Besides inheriting Nana's heavy eyebrows, blue-grey eyes, and aquiline nose, both of them were, like her, outspoken in opinion and firm in adherence to principle. But whereas Auntie Nonnie was exceptionally self-possessed and could make the deadliest remarks with the utmost coolness, father was hot-tempered in the extreme and almost morbidly quick to take offence. Since he was of a generous and forgiving nature, his anger never lasted long, however, and by the time I was born his temper was more or less under control. Indeed, he was an unusually good man. Unselfishness was second nature to him, and it was long before I met anyone who so consistently and so cheerfully put the happiness of others before his own. Auntie Nonnie, who was unmarried, idealised him. This was perhaps natural. Unfortunately, she was also in the habit of singing his praises to Mother, and reminding her on every possible occasion what a good man father was, and how lucky she was to have married him. This last remark was always conveyed in a tone that suggested that having such a man for a husband was a miracle, for which Mother ought to go down on her unworthy knees and render thanks to heaven. Unlike Mother, both Father and Auntie Nonnie had a very lively sense of humour and were excellent raconteurs. Father's stories, which he told me when I had been put to bed, were usually about his own life, especially his school days and his experiences in the trenches during the Great War. In this way I learned how he had given a false age in order to enlist, how he had lived under shell fire, and how he had seen comrades blown to bits and had been himself badly wounded, as well as how he had woken up in a hospital tent without the use of his right arm, which was permanently disabled. While convalescing in the Church Lane Hospital, Upper Tooting, he met Mother, who was working there as a VAD. One of his more amusing stories was about her helping him clamber over the hospital wall at night when he had stayed out after hours. They were married in 1919 when Father was 19 and Mother perhaps 20. 6 years later, in a nursing home in Stockwell, only a stone's throw from the spot where the English Buddhist monk Ananda Maitreya had died 2 years earlier, I was born. At the time of my birth, my parents were living in Nana's house in Tooting, where they occupied the upstairs flat. They had moved there some years earlier when, on learning that my mother was pregnant, Nana had shifted to Southfields. Brick-walled and slate-roofed, with a dusty privet hedge, lace-curtained windows, and highly polished front door. This modest terrace property was one of the hundreds of thousands which, standing back to back in interminable rows, helped to make up the vast maze of mutually intersecting streets that is suburban London. What I take to be my earliest memory, however, finds me not outside the house but inside it, in my parents' bedroom. Lying at night in the big double bed where I had been put to sleep, I used to stare up at the foliated stucco ceiling piece, the size and shape of a cartwheel, from the centre of which depended the unlit gas bracket. As the motors passed up and down the main road at the top of the street, the headlights swung round the ceiling piece like great bright spokes around a shadowy hub. If the motors were going south towards the coast, the spokes swung clockwise. If north, to the city's heart, in the opposite direction. With the clanging of distant tram bells and the low roar and rumble of the other traffic in my ears, I used to lie in the darkness and watch the spokes turning now this way, now that, now both ways simultaneously as two motors crossed each other, until lulled to sleep. As I grew older, I naturally became dissatisfied with passive contemplation. "Mother, can I go out to play?" was my constant cry. The natural playground of the London child is, of course, the street, but there I was not allowed to play until after I had started school. In the meantime, therefore, I played on the black and white tiles of the porch and behind the dusty privet with my sister Joan, 15 months younger than myself, and a girl of my own age who lived up the street. Sometimes we played so noisily that the lady downstairs had to tap gently on the window of her front room to quieten us. When it rained, or when I was not allowed to play out in the front, my refrain was, "Mother, can Frances come in to play?" Usually she could. Our favourite indoor game was dressing up, for which we ransacked the house for old lace curtains. As a special treat, we were sometimes allowed to borrow the embroidered veil in which Father and I had been christened. And then great was our joy, for instead of playing mothers and fathers, as we usually did, we could play at weddings. In my case, this love of dressing up persisted much longer than it did with the girls, and even at the age of 8, I could spend hours in front of the wardrobe mirror experimenting with different styles of dress. Jersey and knickerbockers were not my real costume, I felt, and almost desperately I swathed and draped myself in lengths of material, searching in vain for my true vesture. The only times I felt satisfied were when, with the help of a red ensign, I achieved a toga-like effect, which, though not exactly right, was to some extent what I desired. Gravely holding Grandfather's silver-mounted amber cane, I would then stand gazing at my reflection with solemn pleasure. Halfway up the street, on the other side of the road, stood the school father had attended as a boy, and to which, at the age of 4, I too was sent. Ever since I could remember, I had seen its turquoise-green cupolas against the sky, and heard its bell ringing twice a day. Nevertheless, on the day of my admission, I was so frightened that I ran home at the first opportunity. This reluctance to study did not last long, and I spent in the infant department 4 not unhappy years, the longest period of continuous schooling I was ever to receive. After tea on weekdays, all day Saturday, though not usually on Sunday, as well as practically every day during the holidays, we were free to play in the street. Francis, Joan, and I continued to share our games, for though we knew many other children, we formed a self-contained little confederacy and were happiest playing with one another. We never played all our games on one day. As I look back, it seems that our games had their cycles, and that conkers and marbles, spinning tops and hopscotch, came and went in accordance with laws as immutable as those of physics or chemistry. On or about a certain day in August, for example, all the children in the neighbourhood would begin making grottos. Any attempt to set them up earlier, or to prolong their existence for more than 3 weeks, being regarded as extremely reprehensible. These grottos, which were always built on the pavement against a wall, consisted of shells or small stones arranged in the form of a square, within which could be set flowers, small pieces of crockery, and any bright or curious object. After constructing the grottos, we had the right to sit by them and demand coppers from the passers-by. Another event that loomed large in our year was Derby Day, when throughout the afternoon and evening, and until late at night, a continuous stream of cars, buses, coaches, and horse-drawn carts and carriages, all packed with happy and excited race-goers, would be flowing past the top of the street along the main road between London and Epsom. Waving red, white, and blue streamers, swarms of excited children would be standing on the curb, their parents generally hovering behind to see that they did not fall under the wheels of the vehicles. When, races over and bets lost and won, the stream of traffic set more and more steadily in the homeward direction, our excitement reached its climax. Each brightly lit coach that swung slowly past us would be greeted by a shout of, "Throw out your mouldies!" Whereupon the beerily jovial occupants would fling into our midst handfuls of coppers, for which we scrambled and fought until the next coach came along. At intervals, with the crack of a whip and the jingle of beribboned harness, they would pass by, in all the glory of innumerable gleaming pearl buttons, a pearly king and pearly queen. They were always stout and elderly, while the queen, who was generally stouter than the king, and laughed with even greater heartiness, invariably wore a wide black hat with enormous ostrich plumes that nodded and danced at every step the pony took. Yet another annual event was Guy Fawkes Day. As soon as it was dark, Joan and I, mother and father, and sometimes Nana and Auntie Noni, too, would file downstairs into our tiny backyard, where the guy had already been propped up in the middle of the concrete. After Father had sprinkled him with paraffin, he was set on fire, whereupon the flames would leap up, the smoke swirl, and the darkness be lit up with a ruddy glare, in which our faces would glow crimson, and our voices sound strangely different. Sparklers, which we could run about with in our hands, and Roman candles and golden rain, which had to be set at a distance on the ground, would then be ignited. Catherine wheels would go whizzing round, broadcasting a shower of rainbow sparks, and red and green rockets spring hissing up into the night. Squibs and crackers exploded at our feet. In less than half an hour, our Guy Fawkes would be blazing merrily. 10 more minutes and its head, charred features no longer recognisable, would collapse into the flames, sending up a shower of orange-gold sparks. Within the hour, the bonfire would have burned itself out, and the last flames have subsided, leaving only a mass of glowing embers. Standing silent in the darkness, our shouts and laughter hushed, we would look up through the misty air and see that the stars had come out in the chill November sky. To what extent London children keep up the old customs or are familiar with traditional sights and sounds, I do not know. Perhaps they still hear the muffin bell in the distance, still see the knife grinder pushing his grinding wheel through narrow suburban streets, and the rag and bone man offering tortoises and goldfish in exchange for scrap iron, old clothes, old newspapers, and his broken china. But I am sure none of them ever saw the lamplighter on his rounds. Even before we left the house at Tooting, the old gas streetlights, which on rainy days were reflected in a strange iridescence from the wet pavements, had been replaced by electric standards. As late as 8 o'clock at the height of summer, and as early as 4 o'clock in the depths of winter, the old lamplighter would come down the street. Having set his ladder against the arm of the lamppost, he would climb up, open the window of the glass shade, light the mantel, adjust the flame, and climb down, shoulder his ladder, and be off down the street to the next lamppost. I'm sure there is hardly anything lonelier in the world than a deserted street in a big city, dimly lit at intervals by gas lamps. Not that Jen and I were ever allowed out alone after dark, but sometimes in the summer, when it was fully light at 6 o'clock, Mother would send us to the Broadway to meet Father. Tooting Broadway, where the statue of Edward VII in royal robes dominated the public conveniences from its marble pedestal, and where the trams lumbering past with a dreadful grinding of wheels and shrieking of brakes, was to us the hub of the universe. It was indeed one of the biggest traffic junctions and busiest shopping centres in South London, though Father could remember how, at the beginning of the century, the High Street had been a country road with green fields on either side. Waiting inside the vestibule of the Tube, Joan and I used to feast our eyes on the gilded baskets of colourful hothouse fruits hanging in the windows of Walton's the Fruiterers. Every time a blast of hot air struck us from the escalator shaft, which meant a train had come in, we craned eagerly forward, searching for Father among the crowd pouring through the gate. As soon as we saw him, bareheaded and attaché case in hand, coming towards us with his rolling, rather nautical, stride, we would dash forward and, seizing hold of a hand apiece, lead him home in triumph. Once in the kitchen, I would open his case and take out the newspaper, which was always the Daily Herald. For, unlike the rest of the family, Father was a staunch supporter of the Labour Party. His only concession to conservatism was to take the Sunday Express, a paper Nana also read. Later on, I do not know why, he changed to the People. My own interest in the Daily Herald, which I read spread out on the floor, it being too big for me to hold at arm's length, was strictly non-political. I was interested in following the adventures of Bobby Bear. Only after informing myself of the latest exploits of this hero did I turn to the news. It was from Father's newspaper, I think, rather than from any school primer, that I learned to read. The first real book I ever handled was the Family Bible, with its tooled leather cover and worn gilt clasp, which was so big and heavy that I could hardly lift it. Imitating Father, I called it Grandmother's Bible, the volume having formerly belonged to Nana's mother, who was, however, still living, and whom I saw only once. The rich blues, reds, and yellows of the illustrations, which depicted such subjects as Daniel kneeling in the lion's den among skulls and ribs, and Samson with the ass's jawbone in his hand, had long been familiar to me. One rainy day, when I was 5 or 6 years old, it occurred to me that instead of merely looking at the pictures, I could read the text, whereupon I promptly spelled my way through the first and second chapters of Genesis. If the Bible gave me my first experience of prose, it was from a prayer book that I had my first taste of poetry. In the sitting room cupboard, among Father's books, I discovered at the age of 6 or 7 a volume entitled Prayer and Praise at Eventide. From the inscription on the flyleaf, I gathered that it had been presented to my paternal grandfather by his mother. Opening it, I came upon the lines, "Stay, pilgrim, stay. Night treads upon the heels of the day." This was the first time I had ever met a metaphor, and I can still recall the shock of delight the experience gave me. Though I read the rest of the volume, even the prayers, none of it had for me the magic of those two lines. Nana visited us once a week on the day she came from Southfields to Tooting to see her old friends, collect her rents, and do a little shopping. Auntie Nunny came less often. With the exception of Father's friends and their wives, nearly all the other visitors were Mother's relations. The most frequent and regular of these were Auntie Kate and Auntie Jessie. Only the creator of the aunts in The Mill on the Floss could have done them justice, though neither of them had either the formidability of Aunt Glegg or the airs and graces of Aunt Dean. Auntie Kate, who could not quite be called stout, had a watery blue eye with a twinkle in it, and wore her hair in a bun kept in position by large hairpins. Her nose, which, being the family nose, could only be called long, was red at the end and shiny, for despite the expostulations of Mother and Auntie Jessie, she refused to powder. Their epithet for her was old-fashioned, which was hardly matter for astonishment, since she was the eldest of the sisters, and had already married and given birth to a son, when Mother, who was the youngest, was still in the cradle. Auntie Kate was in fact an old-timer in many ways. Even the sweets she brought us were of a kind that must have been on the market in Dickensian times. Her sense of humour, too, was 19th century, and when on holiday at the seaside, she used to send all her friends and relations comic postcards depicting enormously fat women in bathing costumes and with exaggeratedly prominent posteriors. Yet Auntie Kate was a victim of melancholia, and in later years used to spend her evenings reading Jack the Ripper, after which she would put out the light and sit alone in the dark. Auntie Jessie's epithet was stately, even as Mother's was vivacious. She had a full bosom, kind brown eyes, a musical voice, and was always redolent of scent and powder. Moreover, she was quiet and gentle, with a touch of sadness in her expression. Unlike Auntie Kate, she relished a ribald joke well enough to laugh at one, but not well enough to tell one. And while laughing, she always put her hand up to her mouth, as if to hide a blush, or her rather prominent false teeth. On visiting days, the two aunts usually arrived early in the afternoon, but sometimes they came at 11 o'clock, on which occasions Auntie Kate would scandalise Mother and Auntie Jessie by producing her own lunch, cold meat and pickled onions, out of a brown paper bag. After discussing haberdashery and husbands, and drinking innumerable cups of tea, the three sisters would try on one another's hats, for they all frequently bought new ones, and at each meeting at least one hat was produced, which at least one sister had not seen. This ritual accomplished, Auntie Kate and Auntie Jessie would pull on their gloves, pick up their handbags, and, after kisses all round, depart to catch the tram home. At that period, Auntie Kate lived, as indeed she had always lived, at Fulham, and twice or thrice a year, Mother and I visited her there. As we crossed over Wandsworth Bridge and passed the rows of meanly decent houses, where, at 6 o'clock on a cold December night, one might well be tempted to murmur, "The winter evening settles down with smell of steaks in passageways," Mother would point out to me one house, bigger than the rest, which held a special place in her affections. This was the house where she had been born. Sometimes the sight of the old home revived memories, and then Mother would tell me about the grandfather who had been born in Hungary, and could speak only little broken English, and in whose sweet shop she used to help as a girl, and about the father who had been a clarinetist, and whom she had sometimes accompanied to recitals on the continent. She also talked about her brothers and sisters, 13 in number, not all of whom I had seen. Uncle Dick, the youngest, who, like his father, was a clarinetist, had gone to India at the age of 16 and joined the Governor of Bengal's band. This brother was the innocent cause of one of the cruelest disappointments of my boyhood. When I was 6, he returned to England on leave. The news of his arrival threw me into a fever of excitement, for I assumed he would be accompanied by a whole retinue of Indian servants, and, never having set eyes on an Indian before, I looked forward to his coming to the house with the keenest anticipation. Alas, as the kitchen door opened, and I craned my head forward for a glimpse of the dusk faces with white silken turbans wreathed, which I hoped to see beaming over his shoulder, all I saw were the very European features of Uncle Dick, Auntie Dolly, and my two small cousins. At Christmas time, representatives of both mother's and father's families would be invited to the house, though mother often complained that her side was being neglected. Preparations for the festival began with the purchase of large quantities of holly and mistletoe from a barrow at Tooting Broadway, where the brightly lit shop windows already glittered with tinsel, and where, during Christmas week, the slow-moving crowds of cheerful shoppers thronged the pavements more and more densely every night. The peak was the last Saturday before Christmas, when, with the help of Nana's expert eye, we bought the turkey, and when the last stir was given to the Christmas pudding. In the kitchen and the sitting room, Father would put up paper chains, which we sometimes made ourselves from slips of coloured paper, as well as Chinese lanterns, bunches of balloons, and paper bells. There was also a Christmas tree, which we decorated with iridescent globes of coloured glass saved from year to year, candles of red, blue, green, and yellow wax, and strings of tinsel. The lower branches were hung with presents, while at the top of the tree glittered a large tinsel star. On Christmas Day itself, the first thing I did was to empty the stocking hanging at the foot of the bed and open the parcels heaped on a chair at my bedside. In the toe of the stocking there was always a tangerine. The remainder of the morning was spent in the sitting room, where there were dishes of nuts and packets of figs and dates, and where, at noon, Joan and I would be given a glass of port wine to drink with our mince pie. As the turkey had to be roasted for several hours, Christmas dinner was a late meal. Flushed and triumphant, Mother would emerge from the scullery amidst clouds of steam bearing the turkey, a sprig of holly stuck in its breast, before her on a large oval dish. After dinner, presents were untied from the tree and distributed. In the evening, Father sometimes played his favourite gramophone records, among which I remember an operatic aria sung by Caruso, of whom he was very fond, and Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. From the way in which the clarinet climbed the scale in the opening bars of the latter piece, I called it the aeroplane. Birthdays were celebrated in much the same way, though on a considerably reduced scale, turkey and Christmas pudding being replaced by a birthday cake with the appropriate number of candles, while instead of an assembly of grown-ups, there would be a small gathering of children. But for me, Christmases and birthdays alike always ended in disaster, for I'd get keyed up to such a pitch of excitement that, however tired, I could not bear the thought of going to bed. The result was that Father had to exert his authority and send me off to my own room in tears. Even so early in life did I have to learn that every sweet with sour is tempered still.